Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can robots do for you, and how long will it be before we see them in our everyday lives? Although writers, scientists, and philosophers have been imagining human-like machines for centuries, it has been just a few decades since engineers have been able to actually realize some of those fantasies. In that time, they've made robots more powerful, more nimble, and more precise, and put them to work doing everything from assembling automobiles to exploring the surface of Mars and defusing IEDs. But the greater our ambitions for robotic technology, the greater the technological hurdles to making them do exactly what we want. Joining us to talk about the progress that's been made, we have two guests. Nicholas Gans is assistant professor of electrical engineering at UT Dallas. Ken Berry is director of UTD's Science and Engineering Education Center. Both will be helping out with the Texas Best Regional Robotics Competition this coming Friday and Saturday, November 18th and 19th on the UTD campus. Nick, Ken, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, I want to start with what your definition of a robot is. At the risk of greatly oversimplifying this, why is a Roomba a robot and my old school vacuum cleaner not a robot?
Well, that's actually the first question that I ask my students and the students that come to visit me and my lab. I ask them, what is a robot? And that's partially because there is no single definition, and it's a word that's only about 90 years old, and it's a word that has changed over time. So when you look at what are the common definitions, both from the dictionary, from Wikipedia for the popular definition, looking at trade organizations and research groups, we kind of start to see that it's a mechanical device, automatically controlled, reprogrammable, multi-purpose, able to perform various complex acts. So I think any subset of those, or at least more than half of those, are kind of defined as a robot. When you look at the more popular definitions, you also tend to see the idea that it should have self-agency, or at least the appearance of self-awareness and a humanoid shape. But that's something that was certainly part of the popular any definition probably 20, 30 years ago. And it's more recently we've started to embrace other types, such as Roomba or even autonomous vehicles.
Is it important? Does a robot need to be able to sense its environment?
Absolutely. One of the parts of a definition that I would say that it has to have is a sensor. A robot has a sensor, it's programmable, and it moves in the environment. That's kind of where I would place the definition of a robot. But that could include a garage door. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of moving in the environment, I guess, is something that that keeps it more of a robot and less of a garage door.
So until recently, robots, and currently the robots in factories and such, do not have much sensing of their external environment. They have extremely intricate sensors to understand the position of where they are personally at with respect to themselves, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But they typically have not had great awareness of the environment around them. And that's been one of the challenges that we've been trying to overcome and have really started to crack into that now and get into an area where we can start to make robots that are much better able to handle their surrounding environments.
And the reason, because they weren't that aware of what was going on around them, that was what made them sort of dangerous, right? If you got in their way, they would just keep going.
If you look at industrial robots, they usually have a cage or something around them, mm-hmm. and there's warning signs and other types of things because it could whack you and it could hurt. And actually, there has been a death in, due to a robot doing such a thing. So,
when we look at our senses and compare them with the technology that we can give a robot, on the one hand, there are cameras that can see farther than you and I can see with the naked eye, and there are things that can sense light and sound. But how do they compare with our ability to take in certain information and then process it in our brains?
Well, robots are wonderful because they have the computer, so they can process things much quicker than we can. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of the cars in iRobot, the movie. I could really relate to the Will Smith, or I guess it was the doctor talking to Will Smith, who was saying, "You actually drive one of these things? How crazy is that? This could blow up at any moment." And robots can actually react much quicker, or mechatronic devices can react much quicker than humans can, and they can extend our sight into infrared and other things like that.
I might have to respectfully disagree a little bit. So I do a lot of work with robot vision, and what we call real-time vision processing is about 30 frames per second, which is the rate of a video camera. Mm-hmm. And that is actually hard to achieve even with current computer processors, especially as cameras get more and more higher resolution. It becomes harder and harder actually to keep up with the cameras. So we often find ourselves operating at fairly low resolutions just so we can do all the image processing that we need. It's actually a difficult problem. But one thing that I do agree with definitely is that there's no necessarily reason to limit the robot sensing to what humans can sense. So we absolutely should go into infrared or even other spectrums. We should use sonar. We should use laser. We should use GPS. Absolutely everything we can get our hands on. There's no reason to limit a robot to have the sensing of a human. The other thing that robots are bad at would be understanding and understanding the context. So even if you can have an extremely fast camera system, having it know what it's looking at, that's a problem that's not solved.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about robot movement, because there's been so much challenge in getting a robot that can walk on two legs, or what look like legs to us. Why do we need that? Why can't we just keep them on wheels?
Well, there's two different types of robotics research, I guess, with regards to mobility. Mm-hmm. There's mobility using engineering devices like wheels, and then there's mobility using the way that animals use. It's animal imitation type of research. The Japanese are primarily doing the animal imitation, although there's a lot still being done in the United States on that. But the engineering stuff, like wheels, requires something else, like a smooth road, mm-hmm. Whereas legs, they can go anywhere. They can go over rocks. They can climb high buildings. They can do all kinds of interesting things. They can drop into volcanoes. So they're both very interesting. And they just do different things.
There's something of a debate on this in the robotics community, looking at the utility of both sets of the biomimetic or of the wheels and helicopters and things like this. And I think that for utility wise, in terms of usefulness in the short term, like you suggested, wheels, other means of modality that are much simpler, more robust, easier to understand, are pushing one set. And then the other is what's going to be in the far term future. And we're moving towards legs and other biomimetics, but also just the challenges involved is sometimes worth doing the research in mm-hmm. and of itself, that solving this problem leads to solutions to many other problems. But for instance, you had mentioned that Japan pushing the legged locomotion. And one thing is, during the recent Fukushima disaster, they needed a lot of robots to go and investigate or to perform duties. And they had to import quite a few robots out of France and the U.S. because the robots that were being developed in Japan were more towards the biomimetic side of things. They actually were not capable of handling the situation.
So they're not ready yet, essentially.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about the potential for, as we talk about biomimetic devices, prosthetics. There's got to be a way, ultimately, to allow humans who don't have use of their limbs to have robotic limbs.
Oh, absolutely. There's always a movie that sort of predates the actual engineering that goes on. And G.I. Joe was a wonderful example of that. Mm-hmm. They have there's exoskeletons that are really coming along and can be used with humans who are healthy as well as prosthetics. I think just a few weeks ago, there was a paraplegic who could walk for the first time because of robotic legs. So that's coming along, the bionic person. That's a very interesting and very productive field.
Go ahead.
I think it's one of the most exciting avenues of robotics research in the near term. And if people ask, how will we see robots in our daily lives in the next 20 years? I think this is one avenue where you'll start to see it. if anyone has access to a computer or sometime later, they can do search YouTube for the DARPA Luke arm, which is one of the most exciting robot applications I've seen in a long time, in which an amputee at the upper arm is able to manipulate all sorts of objects and drink water from it and a bottle of water, and it's really, really impressive.
Is this nerve controlled?
It's controlled by muscle. That they have a number of sensors that sense muscle contractions in the shoulder and neck and some other motions and interpret that to be motion. There's some really neat stuff on animal research where they are implanting electrodes directly into the brain, and various animals, monkeys and such, are able to control robot arms to feed themselves. Where this will be with humans is hard to say. These sorts of experiments are go through a lot of regulation and oversight. But we're doing some research, for instance, at UT Dallas on brain-computer interface that is non-invasive, using sensors that attach on the outside of the scalp in order to interpret brain motion or intention and control robots.
So what does it take to learn how to use that if you're the test subject whose brain is making a robot go?
Well, it's biofeedback. Mm-hmm. So you put sensors on your brain or the outside of your brain, hopefully not invasively on your brain, but you could do
that. Have fewer volunteers that way, probably.
Yeah, indeed. You just try to stimulate that part of your brain, and the better you are at stimulating that part of the brain, the better control you'll have over the robot.
There's some terms such as brain plasticity, that the brain is really adaptable and it will kind of relearn how to control things. They've seen this with patients that have lost portions of their brain or had other head injuries, that the brain just sort of rewires itself so that they can redo the things they used to do, but in a totally different way and not the way that the brain was originally designed to be used. So they have done this. They've done some really interesting things where they've people who have lost eyesight, they can give them tactile pressure on the back or on the tongue, and they learn to see based on this tactile pressure from a camera. It's translated to little pressure bumps being pushed on them, and they can read. So there's a lot of things the brain can do that are pretty remarkable.
What does it take to design a robot that learns, and what are the pros and cons of doing it that way as opposed to trying to program in every possible situation ahead of time?
Well, to be honest, you're sort of at the edge of my experience. I work a lot with robot control, which is how to make a robot do what you want it to do. Mm-hmm. But artificial intelligence is really outside of my field.
Well, how do you control it? Talk about what you do work on. I mean, I think those of us who don't have access to these technologies think, well, you tell the robot to do it and it just does it automatically. Why is that so much harder than it sounds to us?
Almost don't know where to start. So just knowing what all could happen is a tremendous problem. There's no way that you can account for all the issues that you might face.
There's a little thing that I always tell novice programmers. Your robot will always do exactly what you tell it to do, but not necessarily what you want it to do. And that's where you get into real issues, is that it will do exactly what you told it to do, but you didn't realize that you put a bug in somewhere.
Mm-hmm. My guests are Ken Berry, who's director of UTD's Science and Engineering Education Center, and Nicholas Gans, assistant professor of electrical engineering at UT Dallas. Both are helping out with the Texas Best Regional Robotics Competition coming up this Friday and Saturday. We will resume our conversation about the past, present, and future of robots in a moment. If you've got a robot question, call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the past, present, and future of robots with Nick Gans, who is Assistant Professor of Electrical Engineering at UT Dallas, and Ken Berry, Director of UTD's Science and Engineering Education Center. If you want to join us, call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Movies have come up already a couple times in this conversation, and I know in part, Ken, that you're trying to explain to us what all this means, but I wonder to what extent science fiction really is an inspiration to people working in this field.
Oh, I think it's very much an inspiration. If you looked at H.G. Wells or you look at some Asimov, and you look at Star Trek and mm-hmm. the cell phone, it all kind of predates the actual invention. One of the things I do is I'm interested in education, and I don't think that science and math can be separated from the language arts because of that. The language arts is creative, and they come up with these ideas, and these ideas generally are great ideas, and it just takes an engineer to implement them.
The word robot actually comes from a literary background, that there was a Czech author named Karel Čapek, and I'm probably not pronouncing his name at all correct, but he wrote a play called Rossum's Universal Robots. And in Czech, there's a word robota, which again, I'm probably not pronouncing correctly, which means forced laborer. And so in his play, they made artificial people who were the servants and worked in all the factories. And eventually the robots got upset with this and rose up and killed all of the humans. So this is a movie that we've seen several times, and this may be the where it originated from.
You know, there is still this sort of lingering anxiety that people have about the idea that we will be replaced by machines or bested by machines. And I'm wondering, do folks designing robots, do you have to have that in the back of your mind at all times, that you have to deal with the ick factor, if that's what you want to call it?
Well, the United States is much more that than, say, Japan.
Uh-huh.
Japan is much happier with robots, and they say that comes from their science fiction, which comes from Astro Boy, from what I understand. Whereas our robots are Terminators, the like. So I think that's very much a cultural issue that we in the West have, maybe more than the East. So there's always that concern. But my thinking is that robots, at least today, are our partners. And they generally don't take over, because there's human attributes that are wonderful and can't be reproduced in any way. There's creativity, there's pattern recognition, things like that humans do and humans enjoy doing. And if you have a robot beside you that's doing the things you don't want to do, then that's a perfect match. And that's the way that most roboticists, I think, are going these days.
So within the robotics research community, there are groups that are very focused on ethical issues. For instance, I am a member of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers Robotics and Automation Society Technical Committee on Robot Ethics.
That does not fit on a business card, does it?
Well, I could give you all the acronyms, which we normally use, but I am on this technical committee on robot ethics, and it is focused on the ethical use of robots, not so much the giving ethics to robots, like Asimov's three laws, although there is some thought about that. But the honest truth is the robots are nowhere near where we would need to worry about such a thing. So it's on people's minds, but we're much more focused on the ethical use of robots. And that includes legal issues. It includes issues of availability, that there's going to be a technical divide or perhaps an economic divide once robots become more widespread. There are people concerned about the loss of jobs from robots taking over jobs that are being held by people. And this is something that Ken spoke to very well, that the current motion is towards human and robot cooperation. You even see sometimes when we're looking at the research solicitations that use words like co-robots and co-workers. So it's really this idea of, can we have humans and robots working together? And as was also already mentioned, that robots are fairly dangerous in an industrial setting, that you cannot get near them. They have you know, the robot we have in my lab has three safety stop buttons that are all over the place. Most of them also have cages and such like this. But there's a big research motion right now towards, can we have humans and robots safely within the same environment where the human handles what they do very well, which is perhaps seeing where things are not where they're supposed to be, aligning parts, perhaps feeding them to the robot, where the robot will then take over and does what it does very well, which is putting things very precisely where they're supposed to be, perhaps very quickly with strengths, stuff like that.
Yeah, there's the four Ds of robotics these days. Robots are good, at least this is in field robotics. Robots are good for doing things that are dangerous,
mm-hmm.
IEDs in Iraq. robots are very good at doing things that are dirty, because we don't like to do dirty things. Robots are very good at doing dull things. So any kind of a factory
repetitive
motion. And robots do things that are very difficult. So mining coal, which is dangerous and it's difficult, and moving it is very hard to do, or very precise things like LASIK surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Or other types of surgeries that are very, very precise and difficult to do, especially after some coffee.
So I've been following the developments on this Google robotic car. I don't know if you guys are keeping up with that. And from what has been released to the public, the tests have been pretty successful. And I have to wonder if it's realistic to think that 30 years from now, nobody will be driving themselves around.
I think this is another avenue where people ask, where will you have robots in our everyday lives in 20, 30 years? And I think automated highways are definitely an area where this could happen. We already have cars that can park themselves. You can spend $70,000 on a car that will parallel park itself. So, and then with the Google, there's also the DARPA Urban Challenge and the previous DARPA Grand Challenges with self-driving cars.
And this one may be a little young for Nick, but there was the Drive Across America, which was in 1995 or... Do you remember the year? But Drive Across America, they actually had a car drive from, I believe, Pittsburgh to San Diego, completely autonomously. There were people in the car, and they would actually take it off the on-ramps of the freeway, but it drove itself.
It seems like it would be hard to get used to not paying attention, you know, being the backseat driver to that robotic car.
I think there are a number of issues. One of them is just going to be there has to be a large enough saturation of these vehicles at once in order for this to work properly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think perhaps automated highways is the way that this would go. And I'm just theorizing here, but I would think that there would be certain lanes dedicated to the automated cars. I think California has already been looking into how they would divvy up their highway lanes, some of which would be dedicated towards self-driving automated vehicles. I don't know if I see in neighborhood driving being the way this would be carried out, but certainly automated highways, I think, are definitely within the foreseeable future.
And they're using robotic cars in the military very often. I don't remember the act or the what Congress decided on. What the particular number is exactly, but by 2015, a third of all military vehicles were supposed to be autonomous. So
we have drone airplanes, but nobody goes inside those, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Is that also a possibility, do you think?
Airplanes? Oh, they are already almost completely robotic.
Will there come a day, though, when private planes are robotically controlled entirely?
So
that's easy, actually.
The current commercial airlines, as I understand it, there's not a lot of pilot intervention any
they
longer.
Take off and they land.
It's the autopilot. I don't know if they even do that so much, that there's issues when suddenly the pilots are forced to fly again and they're a bit rusty because they've relied on the autopilots for so long.
That might not be fair to pilots.
Yeah, we're gonna get a call from the union here.
But from what I understand, it's possible for an airplane to pretty much land itself, but most pilots I think will grab the controls eventually.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Wichita Falls. We have Sarah on the line. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a musician, and in my musician circles, there have been these videos, and I believe it's the Mitsubishi robots that play instruments. And I've seen them playing these instruments. It's amazing with what what would seem like emotion, and I know it's not, you know, are programmed in with dynamic changes, and I don't know what the robots would be made out of, or, you know, to make your embouchure change, you have to use muscles, and so it's pretty confusing to all of us, and I was just wondering if you have seen these robots or have any experience or know anything about them. And I'll take my answer off here, actually.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I have seen some of these robots I saw one by Toyota, I'm not sure about Mitsubishi, that plays a flute, which is pretty remarkable considering that there aren't lips or lungs or anything. Mm-hmm. And I got to be honest, I don't know how their technology works. But on the subject of musical robots, one of my favorites is a recent one that was done at Georgia Tech. And I'm afraid I can't remember the name of their robot, but if you look for Georgia Tech jazz robot, you'll find it. And it plays a xylophone, and it does remarkably well, and it can it can play in the style of several different musicians. And not only that, if it can jam, it can listen to a jazz band that's playing with it. It will adapt to how they're playing, listen to what they're doing. And one of the neatest things is, the caller had alluded to this, that they gave the robot a little head, and it bobs its head and it closes its eyes for no real reason. The robot does not need this, but it's to give it to the people that it's playing with, that they can see it bobbing its head in time, like it's really getting into the groove, and it helps them to understand what the robot is doing and to properly be a real jazz band.
And these, again, these are problem-solving exercises. It's not that someone is thinking, we've got to have, it's too much for humans to be playing music. This is about learning how to control these machines. Is that right?
There are a lot of projects that, if you look at it from a distance, may seem a little odd. There's a big project on having a robot that can fold clothes, but that's a very difficult problem because how do you, remember, the robot needs to deal with things that can be relayed into a number, mathematical equations. Mm-hmm. How do you describe a flexible piece of clothing, which is completely amorphous and can move all over? How do you describe this in a mathematical equation? Extremely difficult. So if we can solve that problem, there's a lot of other problems we can solve. For instance, robotic research, the tools that we use, the mathematics that we use, have been used for understanding protein folding and to develop medications. So there's a lot of things outside of just the field of robots that the robotics research can go into.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Josh in Richardson. Hey, Josh.
Hi. Two questions. One, you were talking about ethics when it comes to robots, which I find very interesting. If we get to the point, say, where you were talking about cars and they're automated and freeways are automated and everything, or even the airplanes, which you, I believe, said are now almost fully automated, if something goes wrong and there's a car crash or an airplane crash when the thing is roboticized, what does that do to people's ability to get any sort of justice for whoever or whatever made the mistake in killing people? That's number one. And number two, I hope you remember this. Michael Crichton also did a lot of things having to do with science fiction at the time. And in the movie The Andromeda Strain, in the book, there was a fully roboticized medical examination system where you didn't have to have a doctor or a nurse. It did everything automatically, and it talked. And he insisted at the time that that actually existed in the late 1960s, but it was kept from actually being used in practice by the AMA, I guess, because it would put a lot of doctors and nurses out of business. I'm wondering if you all know anything about whether or not we actually have a system that could do that medically, and I was curious about both of those.
Well, you've put a lot on our plates here, but we'll see if we can get a response for you. Thanks, Josh.
So from the legal standpoint, this is an issue that the Ethics Technical Committee has looked at, and there are people with law degrees and law backgrounds that look at this. And so, I mean, even a related question would be if someone uses a robot to commit a crime in another state, who has, this is an open question that people have to worry about, who has jurisdiction, or even another country, because this is certainly capable. So while I don't quite know the answer, there are certainly people that are looking into this. You know, there are, as we mentioned, there have been injuries, there have been deaths caused by robots. the question has to be sorted out is, was it the fault of the robot manufacturer? Was it the fault of the person that installed the robot? Was it the fault of the person who programmed the robot? Was the fault of the person who was injured because they were violating safety constraints? So I think there's existing law that can look into all these and settle these issues.
What about medical monitoring by robots? There's a little bit of that going on right now, right?
Well, it's not so much by robots, it's scanners. Yeah. There's a lot of scanners, just like CAT scans or PET scans. They're essentially doing what the tricorder did in Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
But the robots that are being used in medical applications are very advanced, and they're all telerobotic, which means that you have a doctor who is looking at the same thing that the robot is looking at, but the doctor is moving his or her hand quite a bit more than the tool is actually moving. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful robotic surgery is being done by what's called the Da Vinci robot. And all that does is it reduces the motion of the doctor by about 20 times.
Hmm.
So the doctor can go like this, and then the cut is very small and very delicate. And if the doctor has had coffee in the morning or has a slight tremor, the tremor is gone. So to think that something could have occurred in the 60s, or we had the technology to develop that in the 60s, is a bit of a stretch. It'd be really nice if we did. I used to work with NASA, and they thought that we either hadn't gone to the moon, we didn't have the technology to do that, or we had a colony on Mars, and neither one of those, unfortunately, is the case. If they were, we would have been shouting it from the hilltops.
We should clarify, it wasn't the folks at NASA who had those ideas, it was the
Indeed.
Members of the general public.
Right.
Okay. My guests this hour are Ken Berry, who is director of UTD's Science and Engineering Education Center, and Nick Gans, assistant professor of electrical engineering at UT Dallas. Both will be helping out this weekend, Friday and Saturday, with the Texas Best Regional Robotics Competition. We'll resume our conversation in a few minutes. If you'd like to email us, the address is think@kera.org, or the phone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Nicholas Gans, Assistant Professor of Electrical Engineering at UT Dallas, and Ken Berry, Director of UTD's Science and Engineering Education Center. Since you guys are both educators, we'll have a few education questions here. We have one from Daphne who says, I'm interested in starting a robotics camp or club for elementary age students ages 6 to 9 and up. What robots are the best to use for this age group? How can they compete locally? And how should I structure the program? And this is something, Ken, I know that you've given a lot of thought to.
Oh, yeah. That's really where I live most of the time. The best robot for that is probably Legos. There's a Lego Mindstorms kit, and that comes from a book called Mindstorms that was written by Seymour Papert, who was the first to use robots in the classroom. So that's probably the best way to platform to use. But that's it says on the box that that's for 8 to 14 year olds. 6 year old is pushing it.
Mm-hmm.
They have a WeDo, which is a little lower level. That might be appropriate for a 6-year-old. Beyond that, we generally have swallow problems, so we try not to have kids playing with the small pieces.
What are the goals of those programs? I mean, ultimately, some of these kids may end up in the field. Lots of them will do other things. Is this about learning critical thinking and problem-solving skills?
It's about being creative. It's about being innovative, and it's about tinkering.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we are... trying to resurrect is the whole tinkering thing. When I was young, if something broke, we would try to fix it. Today, if you were to take a VCR into a shop, they would say, you know, I could fix it. It would cost you $100, or you could take that $100 and go buy a new one. So there's not a lot of tinkering going on. And a lot of engineering schools complain about that with kids. Their students coming in, their freshman students coming in. So this allows kids to really understand how pieces go together and how a triangle is so much better than a square when you try to put something together. Because a square will squash. But unless you built it, it's hard to envision that a square is less structurally significant than a triangle. So you learn a lot by constructing things and building things and playing with things. And the more you can do that, the better experience you will have when you go into something like geometry or even calculus.
I'd say by the end of this also, they've had a taste of mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, computer programming. So if they want to go into one of these fields, by the end of the experience, a lot of them have decided which one they preferred, which one they like best. There's even a management angle that they have to give a presentation, and some of the students really enjoy public speaking, some would rather not. So there's so many different ways that they can start to discover what it is that they enjoy inside of science and technology.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point about the teamwork. Schools generally are so focused on academics that they don't focus very often on business skills, like working on as a team. Each individual of the team taking responsibility for a different part of the robot, say. One takes responsibility for the chassis. One takes responsibility for the attachments. One takes responsibility for the computer programming. And then they can dive deep in those different subjects. And from what I understand, robotics is being considered a wonderful way to introduce kids to engineering, because they can choose, once they've played with the robot, whether they like the electronics of the robot, or whether they like the mechanics of the robot, or whether they like the programming of the robot.
I know that you played a role, Ken, with the Boy Scouts of America having a patch now that you can get for robotics?
A merit badge, yes.
Yeah. Okay, what about the Girl Scouts? Have you heard from them?
Well, the Girl Scouts developed it before the Boy Scouts.
Really?
Did.
All right.
I was never a Girl Scout leader, but I understand it's similar to a patch that they had. And we worked with many Girl Scout troops when I was in California to do robotics competitions, because they received some sort of recognition for that. So Boy Scouts was actually catching up in this.
Is this still a male-dominated field, or are there as many women working?
Robotics itself, it is male-dominated. I don't know what numbers. Engineering is still male-dominated. But when I have been with these competitions, especially at the middle school level, it's kind of exciting to see the number of young women and girls that are in this, teams that are composed entirely of girls. So I'm hoping that perhaps this upcoming generation will be the one that finally cracks through that representation and gets, you know, roughly equal representation.
We have another email here from Aaron, who writes, what would a potential UTD student who is interested in robotics study and get involved in as an undergrad coming from a community college?
Well, in fact, we've started to increase our outreach to community colleges. UT Dallas has always had a very strong connection to the local community colleges. And personally, I've been looking to strengthen this, at least in terms of robotics. So she's certainly welcome to try to look me up, look at my email address from my website. But we're actually going to start recruiting for our various teams. We have an underwater autonomous vehicle team. We have our BattleBots team, both of which have placed in the top one or two in the past several years in their respective competitions, and just some other general clubs. So we're going to start recruiting for these clubs from the local community colleges. In terms of what you should study, computer programming, honestly, is probably the number one thing. That if you can be a good programmer right off the bat, then you can make really big strides and take the engineering courses and learn that as you go. But the programming is probably the one thing I would emphasize.
If you don't mind, I'd like to go back to the whole male-female thing in robotics.
Sure.
I There's a lot of wonderful role models for women in robots. Donna Shirley was the person who ran the robotics team that created the Sojourner rover at JPL. And she wrote a wonderful book called My Life Among the Martians. And then there's Robin Murphy, who's one of the lead developers of rescue robots. So she's always on the forefront with regards to any kind of a disaster. And there's Maya Martarek, who's from Southern California, and she's developing robots that work in hospitals. She's developing these robots that follow along people to make sure they're doing their physical therapy regime, that they're taking their meds and other types of things. So there's quite a few women who are wonderful role models in robotics.
Can we expect the costs to come down in the same way that computer memory got so much cheaper over the past couple of decades?
Well, if we can find a killer app, we're looking for the killer app for robotics, because there's been a lot of talk about this is the robotic age, just like the 1980s was the personal computer age, and we're waiting for the personal computer to stand up and start doing robotic things. So there's been a lot of talk about it, but there's a need to find that one killer app that will attract everybody to the market, and then everybody will buy it and the cost will come down.
Is the way you power a robot a significant impediment, or do batteries work just fine, or are there debates over the best ways to fuel these things?
It's a major issue, especially for mobile robots, which have to carry their own batteries with them, that actually battery technology has somewhat lagged behind many of the other technologies, where we see these, like you said, sort of exponential decrease in price and increase in power. They are making good leaps with batteries, but it's still a big challenge.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's see. We have an email here from Len who says, while I'm all for automation and for using robotics in unsafe environments, the uses of robots such as transport or as weapons seems to relieve us of our responsibilities as human beings. If we create yet another divide between us and our fellow humans, we become less and less interconnected, less and less disconnected from our basic responsibility of caring for one another. Is this the kind of thing that you all think about?
Well, I don't think that there. I haven't heard of a weapon that discharges on its own, mm-hmm. Without some sort of human intervention.
A human
has to make the ultimate command fire, take out whatever. I think that there's a very strong feeling or sense that we need to stay away from that, but.
Certainly the military use of robots is it's an open issue, again, with this ethical committee. It's something that we discuss. Ken is right that there, to my knowledge, there is no robot that has any weapon capabilities. So the drones that are piloted, they are piloted by a pilot who is remote. And in fact, generally, they have to get permission to fire, and those permissions have to go up several levels. I don't see the U.S. anytime in the foreseeable future taking that human element out. Now, there has been some discussion of, is there a disconnect because the pilot is sitting in Nevada and the plane is in Afghanistan? Perhaps. I can't speak to that.
What are the best ways to communicate with these, the best interfaces? I mean, obviously, some have speech recognition. A lot of them are probably still controlled, right, with a keyboard of some kind.
There's all kinds of wonderful that you just ran into a big field of robotics is the interface.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of cool ways to interface with a robot. You can move the robot and then it will mimic what you just moved.
Hmm.
You can there's a really cool robot from NASA that I like. It's called the Robonaut. And you actually put your arms where the arms of the robot are. Your eyes are seeing what the robot sees. And you can essentially what you do, the robot does. So you are virtually on the moon. You are virtually on the International Space Station, and you move your hand out and it moves its hand out, and you look over and it looks over, and it's really, really neat to see how that works. But there's other robots that are completely autonomous, so there's not much of an interface with it. That's just a really interesting field.
Have you been able to try the Robonaut, like to be the person controlling it? I wonder if you almost lose a sense of where you are after a while.
I haven't been able to do that. I'd love to, though. If you know anyone who can get me in that room, I'd be there.
Oh, so what was the question again? I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right. No, you don't. I'm just looking to see if you needed to add anything. Let me. We'll go to the phones one more time and take a quick question from Michael in Irving. Hey, Michael.
Hi. You've mentioned Best Robotics, a regional competition, a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Well, Best Robotics was started from Texas Instruments right here in Dallas, and it was developed kind of from, I always go back to the movies, I guess, but Apollo 13, when you have a bunch of junk and you've got to figure out how to use this junk to solve a problem. That's essentially what Best Robotics is expecting kids to do. You get a pile of stuff, and then you get 6 weeks to make that stuff come to life and become a robot and to achieve some sort of a challenge. And Best Robotics does that. Texas is by far the epicenter of Best Robotics. We have our challenge or the championship this weekend is called Texas Best, and that's because it's only Texas hubs. The way Best begins is that a hub or an area decides it wants to put on a small competition. They gather up the materials that are necessary for that competition. They recruit schools and provide them registration for free, and then they compete at a hub level. And I believe there's 22 different hubs in Texas. And then the best of those teams come up to the regional, and they will all be here this weekend on Friday and Saturday competing to be the best robot team in all of Texas.
Has it been intimidating for some potential teachers and coaches of these programs to get into it if they don't have that background themselves?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Some of the robot competitions actually don't encourage the teachers to take a lead in the mentoring of the kids, which I find a little disturbing because I'm a teacher. It's a different way of teaching for the teachers. It goes very counterculture to a classroom. You expect kids to specialize on a robot team. In a class, everybody is pretty much following along in the same, same way. On a robot team, you have teams working together. In a classroom, it's often individual work. So it really runs counterculture, and you need to do a lot of professional development with teachers to prepare them in this type of an education. But it's very fulfilling for the teachers once they are.
Ken Berry is director of UTD's Science and Engineering Education Center. Nicholas Gans is assistant professor of electrical engineering at UT Dallas. They are both helping out with Texas Best Regional Robotics at the UTD campus this Saturday, Friday and Saturday. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here.
It was great.
It was a pleasure. Thanks. Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.